says Leonard. And the reason Laura is not here today, Peter, since you don't ask, is that Leonard and I together felt it would be rather better for all parties, including you, if this was a boys-only discussion. What's that supposed to mean? Good old-fashioned tact, for starters, respect for your personal privacy, and the outside possibility that we might just for once get the truth out of you. Naughty smile. Which would then enable Leonard to take a view about how to proceed generally. Fair comment, Leonard, or too much?
Oh, quite fair, I think, says Leonard.
And, of course, to address in rather more detail the issue of whether your personal interests are best represented by having your own legal representative, Bunny goes on, in the unhappy event, for instance, that the all-party-goers simply tiptoe off the stage, which we're told is not by any means unknown, leaving blind justice to have her way with you. Us.
How about a black belt, I suggest.
My witticism goes unnoticed. Or perhaps it is noticed, if only as evidence that I am particularly on edge today. In which case the circus has a short list of eligible candidates, acceptable candidates, let us say. And Leonard, I think you said you were willing to guide Peter's eye if it comes to that, which we dearly hope and pray it won't, deferring with a collegial smile to Leonard.
Absolutely, Bunny. The trouble is, there are not that many of us who are cleared this far up. I do feel Harry is coming on awfully well, as you know, says Leonard. He's applied for silk and the judges adore him, so personally not wishing to influence in any way, go for Harry. He's a man, and they like a man defending a man. They may not know it, but they do.
Who pays for him, I ask? Or her? Leonard smiles at his hands. Bunny takes the question. Well, I think in the large, Peter, much may depend on the course of the hearing and, shall we say, your own personal bearing, your sense of duty and your loyalty to your old service. But Leonard hasn't heard a word of this, as I can tell by the steadfast way he goes on smiling at his hands.
So, Peter, says Bunny, as if coming to the easy part, yes or no, squeeze of the eyes, between men. Did you or did you not fuck Tulip?
No.
Absolutely no.
Absolutely.
Irrevocably no, here and now, in this room, in the presence of a five-star witness.
Bunny, forgive me. Leonard, with his hand up in friendly reproach, I think you've momentarily forgotten your law. Given my duties to the court and my obligations to act as counsel for my client, I cannot possibly appear as a witness.
All right. Once again, if you please. Peter, I, Peter Gwillem, did not fuck Tulip at the Hotel Balkan in Prague on the night before her exfiltration to the United Kingdom, true or false?
True.
Which is a relief for all of us, as I'm sure you can imagine, particularly as you seem to have fucked everyone else in sight.
Immense, Leonard agrees.
And even more particularly, since Rule 1 of a service that hasn't otherwise got many rules dictates that serving officers don't ever, ever fuck their Joes, as you call them, even out of politeness. Other people's Joes, when operationally desirable, yes, open season, just not ever their own. You are aware of that rule.
I am.
And were so aware at the time in question?
Yes.
And would you agree that if you had fucked her, which we know you didn't, it would constitute not only a monumental breach of service discipline, but clear evidence of your louche and uncontrollable nature and your disregard for the sensitivities of a fugitive mother in mortal peril who's just been deprived of her only child? You agree with that statement?
I agree with that statement.
Leonard, you have a question?
Leonard plucks at his pretty lower lip with his fingertips and frowns a creaseless frown.
You know, Bunny, it sounds awfully rude, but I don't think I do have a question, he confesses with a startled smile at himself. Not after that. I think, pro tem, we've all gone as far as we can go and further, and to me, confidentially. I'll send you that short list, Peter, and you never heard me mention Harry. Or maybe better I slip it to Bunny.
Collusion, he explains, bestowing another doting smile on me and reaching for his black briefcase, indicating that the lengthy meeting I had been anticipating is over.
But I do think a man would be good all the same, he says to Bunny, not to me, as an aside. When it comes to the hard questions, men rather have the edge in these cases, less puritanical. See you at the all-party beano, Peter. Tschüss. Did I fuck her? No, I bloody well didn't. I made mute, frenzied love to her in pitch darkness for 6 life-altering hours, in an explosion of tension and lust between 2 bodies that have desired each other from birth and only had the night to live. And was I supposed to tell them this? I demand of the orange-tinted darkness as I lie sleepless on my prison cot in Dolphin Square. I, who was taught from the cradle to deny, deny, and deny again, taught by the very service that is seeking to drag a confession out of me. You slept well, Pierre? You are happy? You've made a great speech? You are coming home today? I must have called her. How's Isabel? I ask. She is beautiful. She misses you. Has he come back, that impolite friend of mine? No, Pierre, your terrorist friend has not come back. You have watched football with him? We don't do that anymore. 9. There was nothing I could see on file, and thank the Lord there wasn't, of the days and nights of eternity that I spent in Brittany after handing Doris over to Joe Hawkesbury, our Paris head of station, at Le Bourget Airport at 7 o'clock on a misty winter's morning. As our plane landed and a voice called out for Professor and Madame Lessive, I was in a state of delirious relief. As we descended the gangway side by side, the sight of Hawkesbury sitting below us in a black Rover car with CD plates and a young woman assistant from his station in the back seat set my heart plunging. And my Gustav, Doris demanded, seizing my arm. It'll be all right. It'll happen, I said, hearing myself parroting Alex's empty assurances. When? As soon as they can. They're good people. You'll see. I love you. Hawkesbury's girl was holding the back door. Had she heard me? My insane outburst spoken by someone else inside me. Never mind whether she knew German. Every bloody fool knows ich liebe dich. I coaxed Doris forward. With a jolt, she landed reluctantly on the back seat. The girl hopped in after her and slammed the door. I got into the passenger seat beside Hawkesbury. Nice flight? He inquired as we raced across the tarmac behind a flashing jeep. We entered an aircraft hangar. Ahead of us in the gloom, a twin-engined RAF plane, propellers slowly turning. The girl sprang out. Doris stayed put, whispering German words to herself that I couldn't make out. My own mad words seemed to have made no impression on her. Perhaps she hadn't heard them. Perhaps I hadn't spoken them. The girl tried to jockey her, but she wouldn't budge. I got in beside her and took her hand. She pressed her head into my shoulder while Hawkesbury watched us in the driving mirror. Ich kann nicht, she whispered. Du musst. It'll be all right, ganz ehrlich, honestly. Du kommst nicht mit. You're not coming. Later, after you talk to them. I got out of the car and offered her my hand. She ignored it and climbed out of her own accord. No, she hasn't heard me. She can't have done. A uniformed aircraft woman with a clipboard came marching towards us. With Hawkesbury's girl one side and the aircraft woman the other, Doris let herself be led towards the plane. Reaching the gangway, she stopped, looked upwards, and, having steeled herself, began climbing, using both hands. I waited for her to look back. The cabin door closed. All done, then, said Hawkesbury briskly, still without turning his head to me. So, the word from on high is, bravo, you've done a great job. Now, go home to Brittany, dry out, and wait for the great call. Gare Montparnasse suit you? Gare Montparnasse would be fine, thanks. And you may be the darling of joint steering, Brother Hawkesbury, but that didn't prevent Bill Hayden from offering me your job. Even today, I'd be hard put to describe the torrent of conflicting emotions that swirled through me on my return to the farmstead, whether I was driving a tractor, spreading muck in the fields, or otherwise striving to make my presence felt as the young master. One minute I was basking in the sensations of a night too momentous to define, and next I was lost in awe at the monstrous irresponsibility of the compulsive, reckless act I had committed, and the words I had or hadn't spoken. Invoking the silent darkness in which our embraces were fought out, I tried to persuade myself that our lovemaking had been only in the mind, an illusion brought on by the fear that any minute Czech security might smash down our bedroom door. But one look at the imprint of her fingers on my body told me I was fooling myself. And no imagining on my part could have delivered the moment when, with the coming of first light and still not a word between us, she wrapped away one part of her body after another, first standing before me naked and sentinel, as she'd stood before me on the Bulgarian beach, then covering herself piece by piece in her French finery, until there was nothing left to desire but a sensible workaday skirt and black jacket buttoned to the neck. Except that I desired her more desperately than ever. And how, as she dressed, the light of triumph or desire quieted from her face, and we became, by her own choice, estranged. First on the bus to Prague airport when she refused my hand, and again on the plane to Paris when, for reasons that eluded me, we were placed in separate rows, until the plane halted and we stood up and started to file out, and our hands found each other again, only to part. On the laborious railway journey to Lorient, no high-speed trains in those days, an episode had occurred which, with hindsight, fills me to this day with a sense of the horror to come. Barely an hour out of Paris, our train came to an abrupt halt with no explanation offered. Muffled voices from outside were followed by a single, unsourced scream, male or female I never knew. Still we waited. Some of us exchanged glances. Others remained determinedly engrossed in their books and newspapers. A uniformed guard appeared in the carriage doorway, a boy of no more than 20. I remember very well the silence that preceded his prepared speech, which, after taking a deep breath, he delivered with commendable calm. "Ladies and gentlemen, I regret to inform you that our progress has been inhibited by human intervention. We shall continue on our way in a few minutes." And it was not I, but the studious old gentleman in stiff white collar seated beside me, who raised his head and demanded brusquely, "Intervention of what nature?" To which the boy could only answer in the voice of a penitent, "A suicide, monsieur."
"Of whom?"
"A man, sir. It is believed he was a man." Within a few hours of my arrival at Les Deux Églises, I took myself down to the cove, my cove, my place of solace. First the trudge down the matted slope to the edge of my land, then another trudge along the cliff path, and at its base the little patch of sand, and to either side of it low-lying rocks like dozing crocodiles. This was where I'd done my boyhood thinking. This was where I'd brought my women over the years, the loves, half-loves, quarter-loves. But the only woman I craved was Doris. I taunted myself with the thought that we had never conducted a single conversation that wasn't cover. But hadn't I shared every vicarious hour of her life, sleeping and waking, for a whole bloody year? Hadn't I responded to her every impulse, every lurch of purity, lust, revolt, and vengeance? Tell me of another woman I had known so long and so intimately before I even slept with her. She had empowered me. She had made me the man I had never been till now. More than one woman over the years had told me, kindly, bluntly, or in outright disenchantment, that I had no aptitude for sex, that I could neither take nor give with abandon, was inept, restrained, that I lacked the true instinctual fire. But Doris knew all that before we ever embraced. She had known it as we brushed past, and she knew it as she took me naked into her arms, welcomed me, absolved me, showed me, then formed herself around me until we were old friends, then careful lovers, and finally triumphant rebels, broken free of everything that presumed to control our two lives. Ich liebe dich. I meant it. I would always mean it. And when I got back to England, I would say it to her again. And I would tell George that I had said it to her, and I would tell him I had served my time and more, and if I had to quit the service to marry Doris and fight the good fight for Gustav, I would do that too. I would stick to my guns, and not even George, with all his velvet arguments, was going to talk me round. But no sooner had I made this great, irreversible decision than Doris's well-documented promiscuity came to haunt me. Was that her real secret? That she made love to all her men with equal, indiscriminate generosity? I even half persuaded myself that Alec had been there before me, two whole nights spent together, for Christ's sake. All right, the first with Gustav in tow, but what about the second night, crammed into the Trabant? One-to-one, snuggled up for warmth, her head on his shoulder, his own words, while she bared her soul to him, and whatever else she bared. Whereas I, blind courier, could practically count the words that Doris and I had managed to exchange in our entire lives. But even as I conjured this specter of imaginary betrayal, I knew I was deluding myself, which made the ignominy more painful. Alec wasn't that man. If Alec, instead of me, had spent the night with Doris in the Hotel Balkan, he would have sat smoking placidly in a corner just as he had done the night in Cottbus, while Doris held Gustav, not Alec, in her arms. I was still staring out to sea, reasoning fruitlessly to and fro in these terms, when I realized that I wasn't alone. In my self-absorption, I had even failed to notice that I was being followed. Worse, that I had been followed by the least appetizing member of our community, Honoré, the poison dwarf, trader in manure, used car tires, and worse. He cut an elfin figure, and a sinister one, squat, broad-shouldered, evil-faced in Breton cap and smock, standing feet astride at the cliff's edge, peering down. I called up to him. I asked him with a certain disdain how I could be of help. What I was really asking him to do was go away and leave me to my thoughts. His answer was to skip down the cliff path with not so much as a glance at me, perch himself on a rock near the sea. Dark was gathering. Across the bay, the lights of Lorient were starting to shine. After a while, he raised his head at me and stared at me, as if in inquiry. Receiving no response, he drew a bottle from the depths of his smock and, having filled two paper beakers from his other pocket, beckoned me to join him, which, for civility's sake, I duly did. "Thinking of death?" he asked lightly. Not consciously. "A woman? Another one?" I ignored him. I was struck, despite myself, by his mysterious courtliness. Was it new? Or had I not noticed it before? He raised his beaker. I raised mine to him. In Normandy they would call it Calvados, but to us Bretons it's Lombic. In Honoré's version, it was the stuff they put on horses' hooves to harden them. "To your sainted father," he said, talking out to sea. "The great resistance hero. Killed a lot of Huns." "So they say," I replied warily. "Medals, too. A couple. They tortured him, then they killed him. Hero twice over. Bravo," he said, and drank again, still looking out to sea. "My father was a hero, too," he went on. "Big hero. Mega. Bigger than yours by 2 meters. "What did he do?"
"Collaborated with the Huns.
They promised him they'd give Brittany her independence when they won the war. Our soul believed them. War ended, the heroes of the resistance strung him up in the town square, what was left of it. Big crowd. Lot of applause. You could hear it all over town. Had he heard it too, perhaps? With his hands over his ears, cowering in some kind person's cellar. I had a feeling he might have done. "So better you buy your horse shit from someone else," he went on. "Or maybe they'll hang you too." He waited for me to say something, but nothing came to me, so he replenished our beakers and we went on looking out to sea. In those days, the peasants still played boule in the village square and sang Breton songs when they were drunk. Determined to count myself a normal human being, I shared their cidre and I listened to the grand guignol that passed for village gossip, the post office couple who've locked themselves in their upper room and won't emerge because their son has killed himself, the district tax collector whose wife has left him because his father has dementia and is coming down to breakfast fully dressed at 2 in the morning, the dairy farmer in the next door village who has gone to prison for sleeping with his daughters, to all of which I did my best to nod my head in the right places while the questions that wouldn't let me go multiplied and deepened. The sheer, unnatural, bloody ease of it, for Christ's sake. Why had everything gone like clockwork when, in any other operation I'd ever been involved in, nothing had gone like clockwork even when it had creaked to a successful finish? A Stasi woman officer on the run in a neighboring police state seething with informants. Czech security notorious for their ruthlessness and efficiency. Yet far from being scrutinized, followed, listened to, and even interrogated, we are gently ushered towards the exit gate. And since when, tell me, had French intelligence been so bloody immaculate? Torn apart by internal rivalries was more what I'd heard. Incompetent and penetrated from top to bottom. And why does that ring a bell? Yet suddenly they're grand masters of the art, or are they? And if those were my suspicions, which they were, and becoming more deafening by the minute, what did I propose to do about them? Confess that to Smiley too, before I throw in the towel and resign? Even now, for all I knew, Doris was cloistered with her debriefers in some rural keep. Was she telling them what ardent love we'd made? In matters of the heart, self-restraint was scarcely her strong suit. And if her debriefers should begin to suspect, as I had, that her escape through East Germany and Czecho had been made unnaturally easy, what conclusions might they draw? That it was all a put-up job? That she was a plant, a double? Part of a high-stakes deception game? And that Peter Gwillem, fool of fools, had slept with the enemy? Which was what I was myself beginning to believe by the time Oliver Mendel called me at 5 in the morning and ordered me in George's name to make my way to the city of Salisbury by the fastest possible route. Not a how are you, Peter, not a sorry to haul you out of bed at the crack of dawn, just a George says get your backside over here to Camp 4 in double quick time, son. Camp 4. Joint steering safe house in the New Forest. Squeezing myself into the last remaining seat of a small plane from Le Touquet, I pictured the summary tribunal that awaits me. Doris has confessed to being a double agent. She is using our night of passion as some kind of diversion. But then the other half of me takes over. She's the same Doris, for pity's sake. You love her. You told her you do. Or you think you did. And it's still true either way. So don't rush to judgment just because you're about to be judged yourself. By the time I landed at Lyd, there was no logic to any of it. By the time my train pulled into Salisbury Station, still none. But at least I'd found time to puzzle over the choice of Camp 4 as a place to take Doris for her debriefing. It was not, by circus standards, the most secret of its archipelago of safe houses, or the most secure. On paper it had everything going for it. Small estate in the heart of the New Forest, can't be seen from the road, low-lying two-story building, walled garden, a stream, bit of lake, 10 acres of land, part wooded, and the whole lot enclosed by a 6-foot-high fence of wire mesh, overgrown and concealed by shrubs. But for the debriefing of a prized agent, snatched only days ago from the jaws of the Stasi that employed her, a little tarnished, surely, a little more visible than George might have wished, if Joint hadn't owned the operation. At Salisbury Station, a circus driver named Herbert, known to me from my time in Scalp Hunters section, stood holding up a sign reading Passenger for Barraclough, one of George's work names. But when I tried a bit of light conversation, Herbert said he wasn't authorized to talk to me. We entered the long, pitted drive. Trespassers would be prosecuted. Low-hanging branches of lime and maple brushed the roof of the van. From the shadows loomed the unlikely figure of Fawn, first name unknown, a former unarmed combat instructor at Sarat, an occasional strong-arm man for covert. But what on earth was Fawn doing here, of all people, when Camp 4 boasted its own security guards in the form of that celebrated gay couple beloved of all trainees, Messrs. Harper and Lowe? And I remembered that Smiley had a professional regard for Fawn, and had used him for a number of sticky assignments. The driver pulled up, Fawn peered in at me, no smile, then with a tilt of his head beckoned us through. The track rose. A pair of solid wooden gates parted and closed behind us. To our right, the main house, a fake Tudor mansion built for a brewer. To our left, the coach house, a couple of Nissan huts and a majestic thatched tithe barn called the Stoop. Three Ford Zephyrs and one black Ford van were parked in the courtyard, and in front of them, the one human being in sight, Oliver Mendel, retired police inspector and long-standing ally of George, holding a walkie-talkie to his ear. Scramble out of van, haul my rucksack after me, shout, "Hi, Oliver, I made it!" But Oliver Mendel doesn't move a muscle. He just murmurs into his walkie-talkie while he watches me walk towards him. I again start to greet him, think better of it. Oliver murmurs, "Will do, George," and switches off. "Our friend is somewhat occupied at the present time, Peter," he says gravely. "We've had a small incident. If you don't mind, you and me will take a stroll around the precincts." I have the message. Doris has told all, up to and including "Ich liebe dich." Our friend George is occupied, meaning he is disgusted, furious, sickened by the chosen disciple who has failed him. He can't bring himself to speak to me, so he has deputed his ever-reliable inspector Oliver Mendel to give young Peter the dressing down of a lifetime and probably his marching orders as well. But why Fawn, and why this feeling of a camp deserted in a hurry? We have climbed a stretch of lawn and are standing obliquely to each other, which I don't doubt is Mendel's intention. Our eyes are fixed on some uncertain object in the middle distance, a pair of silver birch trees, an old dovecote. "I have a sad message for you, Peter. Here we go. I'm very sorry to inform you that Subsource Tulip, the lady you successfully exfiltrated from Checo, was certified dead this morning." And since nobody ever quite knows what they said at such a moment, and I am no different, I won't award myself the mandatory cry of pain, horror, or disbelief. I know I cease to see anything clearly, neither the silver birches nor the dovecote. I know it was sunny and warm for the time of year. I know that I wanted to vomit, but, true to my inhibited nature, managed not to. I know that I followed Mendel to the derelict summer house which lies at the most southern point of the estate, cut off from the main house by a dense coppice of macrocarpa trees, and that when we sat down on the rickety veranda we were looking at an overgrown croquet lawn because I remember the rusted hoops poking out of the grass. "Hung by the neck till she was dead, I'm afraid, son," Mendel was saying, mouthing the words of the death sentence. "A do-it-yourself job. From the low bough of a tree just the other side of that slope there, by the footbridge. Point 217 on the map. Life extinct certified at 0800 hours by Dr. Ashley Meadows." Ash Meadows. Fashionable Harley Street shrink. Improbable friend of George. Circus occasional with a corner in neurotic defectors. Ash is here. With her now. I digest this news slowly. Doris is dead. Ash is with her. A doctor stands guard over the dead. Did she leave a note or anything? Tell anyone what she was going to do? She just hanged herself, son. With a length of spliced nylon climbing rope she appears to have found on the premises, 9 feet in length, presumed left over from a training course, somewhat negligently in my personal view. Has anyone told Alec? I ask, thinking now of her head resting on his shoulder. His policeman's voice again. George will tell your friend Alec Lemus what Alec needs to know when Alec needs to know it, not before, son, and George will pick his own time to do that. Understood? Understood that Alec still believes he delivered Tulip to safety. Where is he now? Not Alec, George, I ask stupidly. Just at this moment in time, George is engaged in conversation with a chance Swiss gentleman, as a matter of fact. Caught himself in a snare in the grounds, poor fellow. Not a snare, more a man-trap. Placed there by an unscrupulous poacher after a bit of venison, we can only assume. A rusty one, lying in the long grass, we're told. Could have been there for I don't know how long, but the spring wasn't bothered. And those dragon's teeth, they could have cut his foot clean off, I'm told, so he was lucky. And to my continued silence in the same conversational tone, the Swiss individual concerned is an ornithologist by hobby, which I respect, being in the way of one myself. And he was birdwatching. He didn't intend to intrude on the premises, but he did, which he regrets, which I would too. What shocks me between you and me is Harper and Lowe not coming across it on their rounds of the estate. They're lucky they didn't walk into it themselves, is all I can say. Why is George seeing him now? And I suppose I meant, at a time like this. The Swiss gentleman, well, he's a material witness, isn't he, son? The Swiss gentleman, like it or not, he was in the grounds. All right in error, a fellow birdwatcher like myself, these things can happen, but at the relevant time, to his misfortune. George naturally wishes to know if the gentleman saw or heard anything of interest that could shed light. Maybe poor Tulip addressed him in some manner. It's a delicate situation, if you think about it. We're in a highly secret facility, and Tulip is not officially landed in the UK, so the Swiss gentleman stumbled into what we might call a security hornet's nest. That has to be taken into account, regardless. I was hearing him, but not really listening. I need to see her, Oliver, I said. To which, unsurprised, he replied, Then remain right here, son, while I refer that one upward, and don't move on any account. With which he strode into the long grass of the abandoned croquet lawn, once more murmuring into his walkie-talkie. At his gesture, I followed him down the massive door of the stoop. He rapped, then stood back. After a delay, the door creaked open, and there stood Ash Meadows himself, a 50-year-old former rugby player in red braces and check flannel shirt, smoking his habitual pipe. "Sorry about this, old chap," he said, standing back for me, so I said I was sorry too. On a ping-pong table at the center of the great barn lay the effigy of a slender woman in a zipped-up body bag. She was lying on her back, toes upward. Poor girl never knew she was called Tulip till she got here. Ash was reminiscing in the breezy voice he had evidently developed for speaking in the presence of the dead. Sooner she knew she was Tulip, God help anyone who called her anything else. Sure you want to do this? He meant, was I ready for him to pull back the zip fastener? I was. Her face, for the first time since I knew it, expressionless. Her auburn hair plaited and bound with green ribbon, the plait lying beside her head. Eyes closed. I never till now saw her sleep. The neck a slough of blues and greys. All done, Peter, old boy? He closed the zip anyway. I follow Mendel into the fresh air. Ahead of me, the grass mound rises to a clump of chestnut trees. There's a nice view from the top, the main house, a pine forest, surrounding fields. But I have scarcely started my ascent when Mendel puts a hand across my path, We stay down here if you don't mind, son. No point in being conspicuous, he says. And I suppose it's not surprising that I didn't think to question his reason for saying this. Then there's a period, I can't do the minutes, when we just seem to wander about pointlessly. Mendel tells me about his beekeeping. Then he tells me about this rescue dog, Poppy, a golden Labrador that his wife is mad about. Poppy, I seem to remember, was a dog, not a bitch. I also remember being secretly surprised because I don't think I knew Oliver Mendel had a wife. Bit by bit, I talk back at him. When he asks me how things are going in Brittany and how the crops are looking and how many cows we keep, I give him an accurate and lucid account, which presumably is what he's waiting for, because when we get to the gravel path that leads past the stoop to the coach house, he steps away from me and says something curt into his walkie-talkie. And when he comes back to me, he's no longer the casual conversationalist. He's all copper once more. Now, son, your attention, please. You're about to meet the other half of the story. You'll see what you see. You won't react in any shape or form, and you will remain entirely silent regarding what you have seen thereafter. That's not my orders. That's George's, personal for you. Furthermore, son, if by any chance you're still blaming yourself for that poor lady's suicide, you can lay off now. Got that? That's not George speaking. That's me. Do you speak Swiss at all? He was smiling, and to my surprise, so was I. The direction of our casual walk took on a chilling purpose. I had momentarily forgotten the Swiss gentleman. I had assumed Mendel was making kindly small talk. Now the mysterious bird watcher who had trespassed by mistake came rushing back in full force. At the further end of the defile stood Fawn. Behind him rose the stone steps to an olive-green entrance marked Danger of Death, Keep Out. We climbed. Fawn led the way. We arrived in a hayloft. Mildewed horses' tack hung from old hooks. We passed between bales of rotting hay until we came to the submarine, a purpose-built isolation cell for instructing trainees in the unlovely arts of resisting and administering harsh interrogation. No refresher course I had attended was complete without a taste of its windowless padded walls, hand-to-foot manacles and head-splitting sound effects. The door was a blackened steel with a sliding eye-hole for seeing in, but never out. Fawn keeps his distance. Mendel advances to the submarine, ducks forward, slides back the eye-hole, backs away again, nods to me. Your turn. And under his breath, in a rush, only she never hanged herself, did she, son? Our bird-watching friend did it for her. On my training stints, there had never been furniture inside the submarine. You either lay on the stone floor or paced in it in pitch darkness while the loudspeakers screamed at you until you couldn't take it anymore, or the directing staffs decided you'd had enough. But these two unlikely occupants of the submarine had been provided with the luxury of a red baize card table and two perfectly decent chairs. In one chair sits George Smiley, looking the way only George looks when he's conducting an interrogation. A bit put out, a bit pained, as if life is one long discomfort for him and no one can make it tolerable except just possibly you. And across from George in the other chair sits a powerful blonde man of my own age with fresh bruises around his eyes, one bare leg bandaged and stuck in front of him, and his hands manacled, palms upwards, on the table like a beggar's. And when he turns his head, I see exactly what by now I'm expecting to see. An old scar like a saber slash running the length of his right cheek. And though I can barely see them for the bruises, I know he has blue eyes. Because that's what it said in the criminal record that 3 years back I had stolen for George Smiley after he'd been bludgeoned nearly to death by the man who is sitting in front of him now. Interrogating or negotiating? The prisoner's name, how could I forget it, is Hans-Dieter Mundt. He is a former member of the East German Steel Mission in Highgate, which enjoyed official but not diplomatic status. During his London tour, Mundt killed an East London car dealer who knew too much for his liking. When he tried to kill George, it was for the same reason. And now here's the same Mundt sitting in the submarine, a KGB-trained Stasi assassin pretending to be a Swiss ornithologist caught in a deer trap, while Doris, who wished to be known only as Tulip, is lying dead not 50 feet away from him. Mendel is plucking at my arm. It's only a short car ride to wherever we're going, Peter. George will be joining us later. What's happened to Harper and Lowe? I asked him when we're safely in the car, this being the only topic that comes to mind. Meadows sent Harper off to hospital to get his face fixed. Lowe's holding his hand. Our ornithologist friend didn't come quietly when he was released from that trap he walked into, put it that way. He required some serious assistance, as you will have observed. I have two pieces of paper for you, Peter, Smiley is saying, and hands me the first of them. It is 2 o'clock in the morning. We are alone in the same front room of the same semi-detached police house somewhere on the edge of the New Forest. Our host, an old friend of Mendel's, has lit us a coal fire and brought us a tray of tea and sugar biscuits before retiring upstairs with his wife. We have neither drunk the tea nor touched the biscuits. The first piece of paper is a plain white English postcard, no stamp. There are scratch marks on it as if it's been shoved through something narrow, perhaps under a door. The address side is blank. On the business side there is an inked, blue-black, hand-printed message in German, capitals only. I am a good Swiss friend who can take you to your Gustav. Meet me at the footbridge, 0100 hours. All will be arranged. We are Christian people. No signature. Why wait till she got all the way to England? I managed to ask George after a long delay. Why not kill her in Germany? To protect their source, obviously, Smiley replies in a tone to reproach me for my slow-wittedness. The tip-off came from Moscow Center, who very naturally insisted on discretion. Not a car accident or some equally contrived event. Better a self-inflicted death that will cause the greatest possible dismay in the enemy camp. I see that as entirely logical, don't you? Well, don't you, Peter? The anger is in the iron control of his habitually gentle voice, in the rigidity of his normally fluid features. Anger is self-disgust. Anger at the monstrosity of what he has had to do in defiance of every decent instinct. Shepherded is Mundt's expression of choice, he continues, neither waiting for my answer nor expecting one. We shepherd her to Prague, we shepherd her to England, we shepherd her to Camp 4, then we strangle her and hang her up. Never I, always the collective we. I told him that he was despicable to me. I like to think it got through. And as if he has forgotten. Oh, and the other piece of paper is for you. Handing me a folded sheet of Basildon Bond stationery with Adrian scrawled large across it. This time in soft pencil. The handwriting neat and painstaking. No needless flourishes. An earnest German schoolgirl writes to her English pen friend. My darling Adrian, my Jean-François, you are all the men I love. Please God love you also. Tulip. I asked you whether you propose to keep it as a memento or burn it, Smiley is repeating to my dazed ear in the same voice of frozen anger. I suggest the second. Millie McCraig happened on it. It was propped against Tulip's vanity mirror. Then, without apparent emotion, he watches me as I kneel before the fire and lay Doris's letter, still folded, like an offering on the burning coals. And it occurs to me, amid all the turbulent feelings that are wrenching at me, that George Smiley and I are closer than we wish to know in matters of failed love. I dance badly. George, according to his errant wife, refuses to dance at all. And still I have not spoken a word. There are certain useful conditions attached to the arrangement I have just made with Herr Mundt, he goes on relentlessly. the tape recording of our conversation, for example. His masters in Moscow and Berlin would not be impressed by it, we agreed. We also agreed that his work for us, capably managed by both sides, will advance him in his distinguished career in the Stasi. He will return to his comrades a conquering hero. The bigwigs in the directorate will be pleased with him. Moscow Center will be pleased with him. Emmanuel Rapp's job is going begging. Let him apply for it. He assured me he would. As his fortunes rise in Berlin and Moscow and his access rises accordingly, perhaps a day will come when he will be able to tell us who betrayed Tulip and certain others of our agents who have met a premature end. We have much to look forward to, you and I, have we not? And still, so far as I remember it, I say nothing. Whereas Smiley, in closing, has something very important to say. You, I, and only the very fewest are owners of this extremely privileged information, Peter. As far as joint steering and the service at large are concerned, we were greedy. We brought Tulip here too hastily. We paid no regard to her deeper feelings. In consequence, she hanged herself. Which is the version that must be trumpeted to head office and all outstations. There must be no exceptions anywhere where joint holds sway, and that, I am afraid, inevitably includes our friend, Alec Lemus. We cremated her in the name of Tulip Brown, a Russian-born woman of faith who had fled the communist persecution and settled to a solitary life in England. Brown, it was explained to the retired Orthodox priest unearthed by the ladies of Covert, who also arranged the tulips on the coffin, was the name she had given herself out of fear of retribution. The priest, an old occasional, asked no inconvenient questions. We were six. Ash Meadows, Millie McRae, Jeanette Avon, and Ingeborg Lug from Covert. Alec Lemus, and me. George had business elsewhere. The service over, the women departed, and we three men went off in search of a pub. What the fuck did the stupid bloody woman go and do it for? Alec complained, head in hands, as we sat over our scotches. All the trouble we went to. And in the same tone of mock indignation, if she told me what she was going to do, I'd never have bloody bothered. Me neither, I said loyally, taking myself to the bar and ordering three more of the same. Suicide's a decision certain people have taken early in their lives. Doc Meadows was pontificating when I returned. They may not know it, but it's in them, Alec. Then one day something comes along that triggers it. Can be totally trivial, like leaving your wallet on the bus. Can be drastic, like your best pal dying. But the intention was always there, and the result's the same. We drank. Another silence. Broken this time by Alec. Maybe all Joes are suicides. Some just don't get round to it, poor bastards. And then... Anyway, who's going to tell the boy? Boy? Of course he meant Gustav. George says we leave that one to the opposition, I replied. To which Alec growled, Jesus, what a planet. And went back to his whiskey.
10. I have ceased staring at the library wall. Nelson, who has replaced Pepsi, is troubled by my inattention. I dutifully resume reading the report that in my grief and remorse I compiled on Smiley's orders, omitting no detail, however extraneous, in my mission to observe the one secret that none but the fewest would ever share. Subsource Tulip, Debrief and Suicide. Debrief conducted by Ingeborg Lug, Covert, and Jeanette Avon, Covert. In periodic attendance, Dr. Med Ashley Meadows, Covert Occasional. Drafted and collated by PG and approved by H. Covert, Marylebone for submission to Treasury Oversight Committee. Advance copy to H. Joint Steering for comment. Avon and Lug are Covert's star debriefers, middle-aged, mid-European women of long operational experience. 1. Reception of Tulip and transfer to Camp 4. On her arrival by RAF plane at Northolt,
Tulip underwent no landing formalities, thereby at no point officially entering the UK. Describing himself as the appointed representative of a service that is very proud of you, Dr. Meadows made a brief speech of welcome in the VIP reception room in the transit area and presented her with a bouquet of English roses which appeared to affect her deeply, for she held them silently to her face throughout the journey. She was then driven directly by closed van to Camp 4. Avon, work name Anna, being a qualified nurse with befriending skills, sat with Tulip in the back, providing comfort and conversation. Lug, work name Louisa, and Dr. Meadows, work name Frank, sat forward with the driver, it being felt that a bonding between Avon and Tulip was more likely to succeed if the two were left alone in the rear of the vehicle. All three of us are fluent German speakers, level 6. On the drive, Tulip alternately dozed and excitedly pointed out features of the landscape that would entertain her son Gustav on his arrival in the UK, which she appeared to consider imminent. She also indicated with enthusiasm paths and areas where she would like to bicycle, also with Gustav. She asked twice after Adrian, and, on being told we knew of no Adrian, changed the object of her inquiry to Jean-François. Dr. Meadows then informed her that the courier Jean-François had been called away on urgent duty, but would no doubt make himself known in due course. Accommodation in the guest wing of Camp 4 comprises a master bedroom, living room, kitchenette and sunroom, the latter being a 19th century glass and timber extension overlooking the outdoor, unheated swimming pool. All spaces, including the sunroom and pool area, are equipped with concealed microphones and special facilities. Directly behind the swimming pool stands a coppice of coniferous trees from which some, not all, lower branches have been stripped. Fallow deer are commonplace, and frequently to be seen disporting themselves in the swimming pool. Due to the wire perimeter, the deer are effectively a domestic herd confined to the estate, thereby adding to Camp 4's air of cultivated charm and tranquility. First, we introduce Tulip to Millie McCraig, Ella, who, at the request of H. Covert Ops, had already that day been installed as safe housekeeper. At the request of H. Covert, microphones were installed at salient positions, and those still active from previous operations disconnected. The safe housekeeper's personal quarters at Camp 4 are situated directly behind the guest suite at the end of a short corridor. An internal telephone connects the two apartments, enabling the guest to summon assistance at any time of night. At McCraig's suggestion, Avon and Lug occupied bedrooms in the main house, thereby providing Tulip with an all-female environment. Camp 4's permanent security guards, Harper and Lowe, share quarters in the coach house. Both men are keen gardeners. Harper, as a qualified gamekeeper, controls the estate's wildlife population. The coach house also contains a spare bedroom, which was commandeered by Dr. Meadows. 2. Debriefing, days 1 to 5. The initial period of debriefing was set at 2 to 3 weeks, extendable, plus follow-up sessions of unspecified length, although this was not revealed to Tulip. Our immediate task was to settle her in, reassure her that she was among friends, speak confidently of her future with Gustav, which by the end of the first evening we felt we had achieved to our cautious satisfaction. She was informed that Dr. Meadows, Frank, was one of several interviewers with special interests, and that there would be others who, like Frank, would come and go during our sessions. She was further informed that the hair director, H. Covert, was absent while attending to urgent matters relating to Dr. Remek, Mayflower, and other members of the network, but was greatly looking forward to the honour of shaking her hand on his return. It being the general rule that debriefings should commence while the subject is still hot, our team reassembled in the living room of the main house prompt at 0900 hours next morning. The session continued with intermissions until 2105 hours. Tape recordings were monitored by Millie McCraig from her apartment, who also used the opportunity to make a thorough search of Tulip's suite and possessions. Questioning was led by Lug, Louisa, according to brief, with subsidiaries from Avon, Anna, and interjections from Dr. Meadows, Frank, whenever an opportunity was offered to explore Tulip's mindset and motivation. Despite attempts to disguise the purpose of Frank's seemingly innocent inquiries, however, Tulip was quick to identify their psychological nature and, on being informed that he was a medical doctor, mocked him for being a disciple of that arch liar and forger Sigmund Freud. Whipping herself into a fury, she then announced that she had only ever had one doctor in her life, and his name was Karl Remek, and that Frank was an asshole. And if you, Dr. Meadows, wish to make yourself useful to me, bring me my son. Not wishing to be a negative presence, Dr. Meadows felt it sensible to return to London, but to remain on hand should his services be required. For the next 2 days, despite such periodic outbursts, debriefing sessions proceeded efficiently in an atmosphere of relative calm, the tapes of each session being shuttled nightly to Marylebone. Of primary interest to H. Covert was the flow of Soviet intelligence on British targets, slight though it was, coming into Rapp's office from Moscow. While accepting that very little of such intelligence had featured in the documents Tulip had succeeded in photographing, there were perhaps matters she had read or overheard in respect of Moscow's live sources in the United Kingdom that she had either forgotten or considered unworthy of report. Was there any hint, any boasting, for instance, of highly placed live sources inside the British political or intelligence establishment? Of British codes and ciphers penetrated? Despite putting such questions to Tulip in many different guises, and it must be said to her increasing irritation, we are not able to point to any positive outcome. The value of Tulip's product should nevertheless, in our assessment, be rated high to very high, bearing in mind that her reporting has been severely hampered by operational conditions. For as long as she was operative, she reported only to Mayflower, never to Berlin Station direct. Questions of potential sensitivity had not been conveyed to her on the grounds that, if divulged under interrogation, they would reveal weaknesses in our own intelligence armor. These could now be put without restraint. For example, inquiries regarding the reliability of other potential or active subsources, identity of foreign diplomats and politicians under Stasi control, the possible explanation of covert pay streams revealed in documents that she had photographed on Rapp's desk but not otherwise handled, the location and appearance of secret signals installations she had visited while in Rapp's company, their layout, their entry procedures, the size, shape, and direction of their antennae, and any evidence of Soviet or other non-German presence on the site, and broadly, any other intelligence which until now had effectively gone to waste due to the scarcity of time available for treffs with Mayflower, the scattershot nature of their conversations, and the limitations imposed by clandestine methods of communication. While frequently expressing frustration and venting it in abusive language, Tulip also appeared to relish being the center of attention, even bantering flirtatiously when allowed with Camp 4's two security guards, Harper, the younger one, being particularly favoured. With the coming of each evening, however, her mood swiftly changed to one of guilty despair, its prime object being her son Gustav, but also her sister Lottie, whose life she claimed to have ruined by her defection. Safe housekeeper Millie McCraig sat up with her intermittently through the night. Having discovered a mutual Christian faith, the two frequently prayed together, Tulip's saint of choice being St. Nicholas, a miniature icon of whom had accompanied her throughout her exfiltration. Their shared interest in cycling provided further common ground. At Tulip's urging, McCraig, Ella, obtained a catalogue of children's bicycles. Excited to discover that McCraig was Scottish, Tulip immediately demanded a map of the Scottish Highlands, so that the two of them could discuss cycling routes together. An ordnance survey map was delivered from head office next day. However, her mood remained uneven, and tantrums were frequent. The sedatives and sleeping pills that McCraig provided at her request appeared to be of little avail. At any point in our debriefing sessions, Tulip would demand to know on what date Gustav would be exchanged, and even whether he had been exchanged already. In reply, she was assured, according to brief, that the matter was being negotiated at the highest level by the Herr Director and could not be resolved overnight. 3. Tulip's recreational needs. From the moment